Supreme Court Chief Justice Berger, who was a conservative justice, has a great quote about this. And he says that the NRA and the gun lobby's interpretation of the Second Amendment is the biggest fraud. He says, I repeat the word fraud ever imposed on the American people. The idea of personal, unlimited gun ownership is not something that we see anywhere in Supreme Court jurisprudence or in American history up until the 1960s and 70s, when there was this backlash to the end of Jim Crow, this white fear, which we saw in Ronald Reagan, banning the Black Panthers from open carry. There's a lot of racism and white supremacy behind this. So that's one. So the idea that this is couched in, constitutional principles, well, the history just doesn't back that up.
Welcome to the I'm All Over the Place podcast. My name is Dara Starr Tucker, and today I am so happy to welcome a guest to have a really, really important conversation around the gun laws in this country, in the United States of America. My guest is someone that I have been mutuals with on my social media platforms for quite a while now. He reached out. It's probably been about a year that we've been following each other, but it's been kind of a mutual admiration society because we do some work that is slightly similar, but you're going to find that our guest is extremely knowledgeable about a wide variety of topics, but just very plugged into the social justice space, and especially issues around race and culture and human rights. He is a human rights lawyer, and I hope you get to learn much more about him today as we have this conversation. His name is Kasim Rashid. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Kasim Rashid, you nailed it. That was perfect.
Kasim Rashid.
Yep.
And I'm so glad to have you here today, Kasim. Thank you so much for joining me.
Dara, a privilege to be around good people. So thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, I am going to put myself in the position of mostly a listener, and I'll jump in there when I'm able to. But this is one of those topics where I think more frank conversation needs to happen around the gun laws in this country, but I do not consider myself in any way an expert about it. And so I want to be able to glean from your knowledge, and I want you to share with us just from your perspective how we can advance this issue in a way that is sensible, in a way that does not shut down the conversation. I feel like in some ways, both sides are just sort of yelling at each other and nothing ever seems to be accomplished. So I think for, those of us who, and it's, anyone who's observing, the horrible issues around gun violence that we deal with in this country, we just want to know that there's hope. We just want to know that there is a way out. And at certain points, it seems like there is such gridlock and there is maybe not very much reason to hope. We're just sort of camping out, looking at our watches and waiting for the next horrible tragedy to happen. But I think also we need to have a conversation as well around the fact that these mass shootings that garner so much attention are really only a small fraction of the gun violence that happens in this country. And so I definitely want to have, a broader conversation about that. But I guess just from your perspective, can you give me an assessment from your point of view? It's a very big question.
Yeah.
But why is gun violence in the United States of America, or in the Americas in general, but specifically in the United States of America, so bad?
The United States in particular is unique in the developed world with this cancer of gun violence. You look at every other developed economy, whether it's Canada, Germany, the UK, Japan, Australia, their level of gun violence is a fraction, a minuscule fraction. I think Japan has less than 10 gun deaths annually, a country of 125 million. Canada's gun violence is one-tenth that of the United States. Germany and UK also, minuscule compared to the U.S. And before somebody listening jumps in and says, oh, well, they have high knife crime. Actually, America's knife crime rates are higher than the U.K. and all of Europe as well. So that's not a very good argument either. That said, I think there is hope. And I say that for two reasons. One, the subjective reason that I'm an eternal optimist, and I've just found that life is better when you believe things can be better and will get better.
Yeah.
We empower ourselves to make that happen. So for me, it's a tool of empowerment as well, that we can control the narrative. We're not helpless. But two, more objectively and quantitatively speaking, on the state level, we have passed massive gun safety regulations. Here in Illinois, we've passed a statewide assault weapons ban. Dozens of states have passed universal background checks, red flag laws, safe storage laws. These are all critical components. They're all elements of comprehensive gun safety. Excuse the pun, but there's no silver bullet to stop gun violence. Mm-hmm. It takes an armor that has different parts and different aspects to it. And we know which bills have been effective. We've got worldwide data. I think the problem, Dara, is it's not so much two sides yelling at one another. It's one side saying, hey, we've got a proven model of what works. Here's the data to back it up. Here's the evidence. Here are the nine safest states in the country that are all blue states that have comprehensive gun reform. So we know this works. And those states are not oppressive. They're not draconian or tyrannical. And here are 16 of the 17 most dangerous states that are all red, with the exception of New Mexico, which we could talk about why. But these states have little to no gun safety legislation. And we see the massive rate of death. We're talking 7 to 8 times that of blue states. And so it's one side offering data and evidence and the other side offering thoughts and prayers. Mm-hmm. And I say this as a person of faith who prays 5 times a day. I believe in prayers, but I also believe, as in James 2:10, faith without works is dead. Mm-hmm. And this is mind-boggling to me that the same people who Bible thump seem to forget that pretty critical component of faith, that without works, it's dead. And so I would very respectfully push back on the idea that it's two sides screaming at each other. I see it as one side saying we have a solution and the other side just living in an alternate reality. And in the meantime, our children are dying unnecessarily.
Hmm. So I will ask, I did a sketch about this where I talked about this podcast, this episode of the podcast, and I sort of directed people to it. But the launch, sort of the launching point within that sketch, was having a conversation with a quote unquote person of faith. And in my case, Christian person. These are the types of people that I grew up with who make these sort of faith-based arguments about, well, this cannot change. Legislation will not change it. This is a heart problem and not a legislation problem. It really doesn't matter. So I guess, first of all, do you encounter that sort of thinking within the Muslim faith? Is that an issue in your world as well? And then secondly, how do you respond to that if you do encounter that kind of thinking, or if you speak to Christians who feel that way?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Joseph M. Wanted with the Christitutionalist Politics. Tune in for the upcoming episode for May 4, Issue Never the Issue, as well as guests Peter Serafin, Rosemary Downer, Don Gallade, Gista the Rapper, Cy Young, Jason Perry, and upcoming Jack Hagar, Andrew Thorpe King, Trent Rock, Ed Temple, Chris Morehouse, and more. Please tune in to Christitutionalist Politics. God bless.
You know, I not necessarily in the same way within the Muslim community, just for the sake of discussion, let's make it a model of the community for the sake of this discussion. Not necessarily the same way, because I don't think the argument from the Christian perspective is rooted in Christianity. I think it's rooted in nationalism, with Christianity as the veneer, as the excuse. Mm. I don't recall Jesus saying, carry around 10 swords in case you get slapped on one cheek so you can chop their heads off with the 10 swords, right? I mean, there's no Christian argument for being armed to the teeth. You can't convince me that a man who said that all things are possible through faith would suddenly say you need all these firearms as well. There's a contradiction in terms. So mm-hmm. I do see it among just fundamentalists in general. where there is this fear of the other. And that transcends Christianity, Islam, Judaism. It transcends religion as well, because you see it among atheists as well, where there's this constant fear of the other. And we put the veneer of religion, or we put the veneer of something else, but it really comes down to coming from a place of being afraid all the time. From the Islamic perspective, to bring theology into it just for a moment, the idea of firearm ownership as a means of self-defense is perfectly acceptable. There's nothing wrong with that. And so when I'm critical of gun laws, it's not because I'm anti-gun, it's because I'm pro-common sense. Mm-hmm. My brother's a U.S. Marine veteran. And one reason why he shot expert every year in the Marine Corps is because when he was 15, our parents got him a gun, a pellet gun. It wasn't like, it barely broke skin, but it was enough to get him started. And then we upgraded and we went hunting. And, so we were handling firearms safely since we were young. So I get it. I get the whole idea of handling firearms and doing it in a safe way. But I also remember the training that our parents put us through. And I also know that once he entered the Marine Corps, the amount of training he had to go before he was allowed to handle the equivalent of an AR-15 in the military, an M-15 rifle. So that, I think, is the difference, right? That is where I'm like, yeah, let's have access to firearms, but the same way we have guidance and training for people in the military, because the military understands you don't let some 18-year-old kid join the military and give him a weapon of war and say, hey, go figure it out. We give him training. We don't allow firearms on military bases, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't we apply that same strict standard to the ordinary person walking around on the street?
Mm. So you are, your field is law. You are a human rights lawyer. That's correct.
Yes.
So from a legal perspective, I guess, I'm interested in, because, we always throw out the example of Australia. You know, they had a mass shooting back in, I think it was 1996. And after that, they did a whole buyback program, mandatory buyback program. They confiscated all kinds of firearms and have not had, a mass shooting since then. And their rate of firearm death is very low in Australia. They do not have the same gun culture, quote unquote, that we do here in the United States. But from your perspective, from a legal perspective, I guess, what do you feel like the limitations are in terms of the laws that we are able to create around gun ownership and restrictions around gun ownership, considering the fact that that is codified into our constitution? I mean, do you feel that is the primary impediment or the brick wall that we run into?
So a couple of things. Great question, Dara. A couple of things to think about. Supreme Court Chief Justice Berger, who was a conservative justice, has a great quote about this. And he says that the NRA and the gun lobby's interpretation of the Second Amendment is the biggest fraud. He says, I repeat the word fraud ever imposed on the American people. The idea of personal, unlimited gun ownership is not something that we see anywhere in Supreme Court jurisprudence or in American history up until the 1960s and 70s, when there was this backlash to the end of Jim Crow, this, white fear, which we saw in Ronald Reagan, banning the Black Panthers from open carry. There's a lot of racism and white supremacy behind this. So that's one. So the idea that this is couched in, constitutional principles, well, the history just doesn't back that up. Two, the idea that we have to abide by one narrow interpretation of the Second Amendment from 230 some years ago is also asinine. Imagine for a moment, if I said, Dara, you have 27 words and you need to craft a comprehensive law that will govern weapons invented in the year 2300. And there's no other interpretation except the one. We can't even imagine what kind of weapons will exist at that time. We have no idea, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, our limitation of weapons is firing little metal bullets. Who knows what kind of sonic technology or, solar technology or subversive skin technology. We can't fathom it. And that's what we're expected to do here, that these enslavers from 250 years ago, who couldn't have fathomed technology the way it is now, whose, while the founding document said all men are created equal, it actually meant white enslaving land-owning men and nobody else, that's whose opinion we're supposed to accept? I mean, it's laughable to say that. So that's the second point. The final point is this, and I think this is the key point that we need to be clear. Even the most ardent pro-NRA, pro-unlimited gun ownership person will say, yeah, there's a limit, right? We don't have ground surface-to-air rocket launchers available at Walmart, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have nuclear. You can't go to your local Lowe's and pick up a nuclear weapon, right? They admit there's a line. And so by virtue of there being a line, they admit it's subjective. Now the question really comes in, what is that subjectivity supposed to be? Well, mm-hmm. if they want to be originalist and they want to be critical. You know, this is what they all say. Well, I'm a textual originalist and, whatever it originally says is what I'm going to go for. Okay, let's go with that argument. Let's go with the firearm that was in front of them at the time, the musket, that had the ability to fire one round every 30 seconds. And you needed that stupid stick that you put in there to load up one pellet or whatever it was and fire that. Mm-hmm. If you want to be originalist, let's go with that. People can have as many of those as they want. I don't care. I'm good with that. The ones that could shoot 10 feet straight and the bullet would curve. Knock yourself out. But every single aspect of the argument, it just doesn't hold water. If you want to talk mm-hmm. about, it shall not be infringed. Okay, well, let's look at the first half of that. A well-regulated militia being necessary. Well, a well-regulated militia is no longer necessary at all. So then the second half doesn't even apply. This idea of, I've seen people cherry pick verses of the Bible, of the Quran. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this idea that you're going to cherry pick half of an amendment to fulfill your needs, there's just no rhyme or reason behind it. So legally, I think the argument is untenable. It makes no sense whatsoever. And ultimately, if the idea, and the last point I'll make is this before I stop my rant, the idea is that we need these firearms to prevent government tyranny from happening. Well, there's two things I would say about that. One, if you truly believe that these firearms are necessary to prevent government tyranny, you would have been in the streets marching when Philando Castile was killed.
Mm.
Because he had a legal licensed firearm that he disposed as he was supposed to, and he was murdered in cold blood. You would have been marching in the streets when Breonna Taylor was killed.
Yeah.
Because her boyfriend shot back in self-defense because police didn't announce who were coming. You had been marching in the streets every single time a licensed Black gun owner is killed, but you don't. You don't care about that at all. And two, if the government actually wanted to commit atrocity in the modern day, as they have in the past, talk about the MOVE bombing, we talked about Tuskegee, we talked about other forms of atrocities, the Japanese concentration camps, they're going to do it. And your little pellet gun, your little AR-15 is going to do nothing to a tank. So rather than having this fear of government, which Ronald Reagan started, let's talk about why we need a government by, of, and for the people that is accountable to the people, where you don't have to live in constant fear and this, bizarre fantasy, murderous fantasy of having a rebellion or a revolt against the government. It's nonsensical. It has no rhyme or reason to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did a little bit of reading and research around the sketch, the sort of satirical sketch that I did on this a couple of days ago. And I sort of ran into some interesting data that surprised me. And I kind of want you to comment on that a bit. I guess the perception is, and I don't have the stats in front of me, but the perception I think is for a lot of us who maybe don't live in the so-called heartland or in rural areas or whatever, the perception is that the majority of the people or the statistics that are often quoted that the majority of the people in the United States are in favor of sensible gun laws, universal background checks, and just go down the list. Most people are in favor of these things. And that what's really happening is that the NRA is lobbying politicians, lobbying our legislators, and lining their pockets. And this is a lot of why we are not allowed to have this sensible legislation. They are going against, these legislators are going against the will of the people. That is that, those are the statistics that I hear often quoted. And that is the general perception. If the people could have what they wanted, we would have more sensible gun laws. But many of the statistics that I encountered in researching for that sketch were that these lawmakers, particularly in rural areas and in red areas, their constituents are not in favor of tighter gun laws. If they were to vote for tighter gun laws, they would lose their jobs. So is it your, I guess, experience that this is really an issue of the will of the people, or is this more of a situation of what is happening with the gun lobby? Are legislators, if they were able to act courageously and just simply say, I do not want NRA money, I refuse to accept it, would their jobs still be in danger?
Probably, but not due to the people, but due to the hold that the NRA has on enough other politicians. After the Buffalo mass shooting, I think that was last year, it's hard to keep track anymore, where the white supremacists targeted a Black majority, predominantly Black frequented grocery store, the Republican in that district said, we need to have tighter gun laws. He didn't say a gun ban, he just said, we need to have better background checks. The NRA and other gun lobbyists got rallied against him, and the party ousted him. The Republican Party ousted him, and he no longer has a seat. And so this is where it's not as simple. Like I said, there's no silver bullet. I keep using that example. It's
right.
One, but there's no one silver bullet to fix this issue. It goes much further beyond that. Look, I run for office in rural parts of the country before. And I saw a number of calls about 5 years ago. I was in a very rural part of Virginia. And we were at an event, and there was a sheriff on duty there as well. And we were going to be asked about gun reform, gun safety. It was not long after Parkland, so maybe it was 4 years ago. My timeline is a bit fuzzy as to when, but it was shortly after Parkland. And the sheriff comes up to me, and he says, so what, you know, why do you guys want to take our guns away? And I said, well, you know, sheriff, I reject that framing. What I want to do is make sure that the only people who have firearms are the people who are trained on how to handle a firearm. You talk about, you know, there's no such thing as an accidental shooting. It's a negligent shooting, right? When somebody, you know, shoots themselves in the foot, it's not accidental, it's negligent. It's negligence. That's the key word that we use in the industry. And so I want to make sure we limit the negligence, you know, the 30 or so people killed a year because their toddler got their gun out of their purse or out of their safe or what have you and killed them. These are all things that can be prevented. The fact that guns are the weapon of choice for people who die by suicide. All the studies show that if we can simply delay that ability for them to get a firearm in that situation, we can save a significant number of lives because it gives us time to intervene and intersect. It gives them time to maybe rethink what they're about to do. And as I described this to him, the last thing I said was, and I want to make sure that when your deputies are called to a scene, whatever it is, that they know that everyone there who has a firearm is supposed to have a firearm. And then the light bulb suddenly went off. He goes, you know, I'm a lifelong NRA member, and that makes perfectly good sense to me. He's like, why can't we have background checks to make that happen? I'm like, that's a great question for your NRA colleagues, because they're the ones preventing it from happening. So, you know, I think the propaganda from the NRA is so massive, it's so reckless, that people aren't truly aware of how bad and dangerous it actually is. Since Columbine, we have put 10,000 police officers in schools. 10,000. They have stopped maybe one shooting in a school. More unarmed teachers have stopped shootings than armed police officers. So the idea that we can double number to 20,000, to 30,000, to 40,000, okay, so we'll stop four shootings? Well, there have been 180 mass shootings in schools since Columbine. And you want to talk about that as the solution, it's nonsensical. So I don't believe people in rural America overwhelmingly want more guns, especially because those red states have the highest per capita gun death in the country. I mean, we're talking, again, 7 to 8 times the blue states. I think the problem is that there is so much NRA money, lobbyist money, which again is tied to our broken campaign finance system due to Citizens United, that even if a Republican did want to speak up and say, hey, I can't do this anymore, we need gun reform, they'll be ousted before they get back to their office.
Hmm. So why do you think, I guess, that the NRA, first of all, is so resistant to these sensible gun laws? I mean, it would seem to me that it would be bad business, just bad PR in general for them, for mass shootings to be happening, for, you know, the inner cities to be just overrun with guns and crime. And that's not a very, very good calling card for them as an organization. So why, from a PR perspective, I guess, do you feel that they are so resistant to these basic perimeters that many people want established? Why does it take such a loose approach on their part to bolster their organization or their point of view? Why can they not simply exist in harmony with everyone? Why are they so why are they so virulently against these laws?
Well, I think they're not looking at it from a place of common sense. They're looking at a place of white nationalism and racism. If you look at every single NRA policy and action, it's grounded in ultimately racism. You go back to Reagan and the NRA partnering after the Black Panthers marched with open carry and banned open carry in California. I mean, let's be honest about this. That was done by a Republican governor. He banned open carry in California. And people talk about how California is this, you know, this liberal hellhole. Well, first of all, I think it's number 7 in low gun death rates in the country. And two, we actually have Ronald Reagan to thank for that. It's his racism that saved lives. This is an ironic thing to say. But his policy was not grounded in safety. It was grounded in white supremacy. And that's just a fact. I mentioned the Philando Castile situation earlier. There's a great book by Professor Jonathan Metzl of University of Tennessee called Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. And he talks and argues really with some brilliant facts and data that the polarization of the U.S. gun debate is really grounded in racism and white supremacy, because you have you still have this lingering backlash, not lingering is probably the wrong word, it's large backlash from the end of Jim Crow. And this is not unique in American history. We saw the backlash after the Civil War, where even though civil rights acts were passed, the Supreme Court overruled them. And we saw black codes and Jim Crow come into place. We saw segregation come into place. When that was repealed, you saw the backlash of mass incarceration, the war on drugs, and the proliferation of firearms, massive proliferation of firearms, predominantly by majority white Americans. You look at the data, white Americans own the vast majority, far out of their proportion of their population in the U.S. And then you also have a shrinking white population as well. I think we're only about 20 years away from being a minority-majority country. My eldest was born in 2009, the first year where more non-white kids, where black and brown kids were born than white kids. And so you have this white nationalist view that we're a dying race, and like as if that's not white supremacist at all. And you have this fear. I saw this tweet some years ago. I can't remember who said it, but we can probably Google it, where the person said, why are white Americans afraid of becoming minorities in America? Are minorities in America mistreated or something? And it just brings up the point. And so you have this view, this dying of whiteness view that Professor Metzl talks about, that this is my last stand. And mm-hmm. I need to hold on to my guns to protect myself, protect everything I own and hold and cherish. And then you have someone like a Donald Trump talk about Make America Great Again, reviving this, you know, pre-civil rights era, when Jim Crow was the status quo, and white Americans didn't have to compete with women. They didn't have to compete with Black people or with brown people or with Asians, because they had every advantage already given to them. And, you know, it comes down to that old saying that when you've had privilege your whole life, equality feels like oppression. And so that's, the NRA has tapped into that very effectively. And fortunately, they're slowly but surely losing the battle. But in the meantime, the martyrs of that battle are literally our children, because now gun violence is the leading cause of death for children in America. But I want folks to really focus on this and think about this, that this is not about what they wanted. They want to frame it as a constitutional battle. It's not about that at all. This is a view from the white nationalist perspective that where the white race is dying, this bizarre concept, because race obviously is a construct, and that scares the bejesus out of them. And this is their response to that. And our response has to be activated, to be organized, and not just vote on election day, but to be active year round in supporting candidates, good candidates, knocking doors for them, making phone calls. If you can donate, donate, but being engaged throughout the political and civic process so that on election day, candidates committed to actual gun safety win and are able to have the power to bring about the changes that 93% of Americans want.
Hmm. Well, you're so thorough, because you've answered two questions that I wanted to ask you. And that was first about how race plays into all of this and just the history of gun ownership and how this fight is so inextricably tied to the history of race in this country. And then secondly, actionable things that you feel that people can do to maybe rid themselves of that feeling of helplessness, because I think that's, you know, that's what a lot of us experience. I had a friend who posted something the other day that it was the coach. I don't even know. Forgive me. I am sports illiterate, but there's a coach who's often outspoken about these social issues.
Coach Pop, Spurs coach, yes. Popovich. Yep.
Yes, and he basically implied, I think rightly so,
yeah,
that the only way that the United States tends to move forward on certain issues is when we see something very stark and very ugly on display, when we are forced to visually confront the thing that we have been ignoring. And so I don't know, for me, this gun issue just seems, and for a lot of people, I'm sure this gun issue seems like it's just such a contradiction, I would think, of just basic human instinct in terms of our need and our desire to protect the children of this world. I mean, you would think when half of these mass shootings are happening in schools, Republicans are parents too. You know, they go to the grocery store too, and they experience the same fears that we do around this stuff. Do you feel in any way that that there is the need for something drastic to happen that is able to be viewed? And I'm talking about in terms of the 9/11, you know, where that just turned people around in terms of our relationship with the Muslim world, and we weren't aware and didn't care and didn't know and weren't thinking about what they thought of us until that horrible visual thing happened. George Floyd would be another example of something that just came and smacked us across the face, smacked many people across the face, and said, this is a problem. Black people are treated differently by law enforcement. Do you feel that there is something drastic that is needed that needs to shake up the culture? Are you of that belief, that horrible belief?
You know, it's such an important question. I've heard people suggest that there needs to be an Emmett Till equivalent. His mm-hmm. mother had an open casket for Emmett because she wanted the world to see what white supremacy did to her baby.
Yeah.
And it's a courageous, painful decision for any parent to ever have to make. And so I can't sit here and say, you know, the parents of Newtown should have had open caskets, or the parents of Uvalde should have had. I mean, that's not my place to say or think or even suggest.
Right.
I will say that when things like Newtown or Parkland or Columbine or Uvalde or God knows how many other schools and churches and synagogues have had these shootings, I mean, it decimates an entire community. And mm-hmm. I don't mean the people who die. I mean, the people who have been impacted by that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are now, I think, 200 or 300,000 kids in the U.S. that have had direct experience with gun violence simply because of they went to school that day.
Mm-hmm.
Astronomical, absurd number. I have, it's hard to find somebody who hasn't been affected by gun violence. I lost one of my childhood mentors to gun violence when I was in my early 20s. Somebody I cared for and loved deeply was killed, actually saving somebody else's life. He was shot in the back while saving somebody else's life.
Mm.
And so I feel like with 40,000 plus deaths a year, 20,000 of them being suicide, I feel like we've all heard of someone who was shot or have a family member who was killed or a loved one who maybe died by suicide. I mean, I feel like we're all there. So I don't necessarily know if that is what's necessary. And I don't know what that actually looks like. Yes, disaster brings us together, but not always, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you mentioned 9/11 earlier, and you know, there's these memes from liberals going around and some conservatives every year after 9/11 that I don't want to remember the pain of 9/11, but I want to remember the unity we experienced on 9/12. And I'm like, I must have slept in on 9/12 or something, because I don't remember that unity. I remember being pulled over by law enforcement 70 plus times in the next 2 years and not getting
wow.
a ticket. I remember our Sikh sisters and brothers suffering discrimination because they're more visibly, you know, quote unquote, foreign, because they wear a pagri, a turban. I remember the first victim of a hate crime of 9/11 was a Sikh American. Mm-hmm. And so there's like a rose-colored glasses that folks have. And so I don't ascribe that we need to see the suffering closer firsthand. I think we've seen enough suffering. My fear is actually the opposite. My fear is that I don't want people to get calloused to the suffering. I don't want them to become numb to the suffering, because it is, I think, a psychological human phenomenon to force yourself to recluse in when there's immense suffering. We saw this with COVID, right? We saw, you know, oh my God, 1,000 have died. Oh my God, 10,000 have died. Mm-hmm. 100,000, an incalculable loss. You know, that was a New York Times headline. And then when we hit 1,000,000, it was like, meh,
mm-hmm.
that sucks. 1,000,000 died. You know, people were like, they were apathetic to it. The reaction from 100,000, which is called an incalculable loss, to by the time we got to 1,000,000, it was like, all right, yeah, that's terrible. But, you know, it is what it is type thing.
Right.
And so that's kind of my fear, that I don't want people to become desensitized to it. And that's where I really just go back to my earlier point, where I want people to take the anger that they experience. And if you pray, good, put it into prayers, but then also follow it up with action. And there's no shortage of the actions that we can do to bring about that meaningful change. And the last comment I'll make about that is this. People sometimes think that because we haven't gotten immediate snap of the finger change, the change isn't coming. We see how the GOP has worked to instill their restrictive bills. Let's take abortion, for example. It took them 50 years after Roe v. Wade was ruled for them to repeal it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It didn't happen overnight. It took them half a century to do it. And you can make a strong argument that they never should have gotten that far, because we should have codified reproductive health access in law. But it took them 50 years and they kept on chipping away at it, and then we saw what happened last year. And with something like this, gun safety, we made progress, right? We had the assault weapons ban. It got repealed and we saw what happened. But I don't want people to lose hope, because I want them to feel empowered that your voice matters. You matter, and you can, because you give a damn, we can bring about that change. But don't lose that element of being angry. Find ways to channel it to something productive that will bring about the change we need.
So if you had three recommendations for people wanting to invest their time, energy, effort, money, organizational skills, whatever it is, what would be your top three kind of actionable items that you would recommend that people do to push this issue forward and to push for a safer environment in terms of gun violence?
If you want to transform society, give yourself ammo. And this is the kind of ammo I'm talking about. It's an acronym. Activate, mobilize, and organize. Activate first by understanding your surroundings. You should know, who is my city council person? Who is my county supervisor? Who is my state representative? Who's my state senator? Who's my member of Congress? Who's my U.S. senator? Who is my dog catcher? You should know all these names personally, because you should find time to go to the town halls. You should find time to go to the city council meetings. You should be involved on all these local meetings. So first is activate yourself by understanding who are your local community leaders, because I guarantee you they have a far bigger impact on your day-to-day life than Joe Biden or any president or anybody on the federal scale. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing, activate by doing that. Next, mobilize. Understand what are the local issues that people are trying to address. Gun violence is one big one, but there's others as well. Are teachers being paid enough? That's a state issue. Do the local park districts have enough funding? That's a local issue, right? It's a city issue. Is the tax revenue being collected and spent in the right way? Mobilize by understanding those issues and going to those meetings and being involved and engaged. And then third, organize. See where the gaps are and understand what's causing those gaps to exist. And then organize people. Get your spouse, your kids, your parents, your neighbors, your cousins' neighbors, anyone you can think of, your church community, your mosque community, your secular community, whoever is in your circle of influence, be the organizer to pull them along, drag them along, kicking and screaming if you have to be involved in a campaign. Organize behind the right candidate. Find the person who's fighting for working families, who's rejecting corporate money, and who's leading with a sense of dignity and compassion and humility, and get behind them, knock doors for them, send text messages for them, make phone calls for them. If you can donate some money to their campaigns, because monies require campaigns. That organizing is super effective, and then be consistent about it. You can't just try one campaign, be like, well, we didn't get the victory, I give up, it doesn't work. That's defeatism. It's going to take two cycles. It's going to take four cycles. It's going to take a decade. But when you're consistent and you become that organizer, you're going to attract more people. They'll follow your lead. And they're going to want to be inspired by wanting to be more involved. And I can't emphasize this enough, Dara. It's not easy. None of this stuff is easy. It's all extremely difficult. I'm reminded of James Baldwin when he talks about the struggles of Black people in particular. But I think this applies to, he says, people of color and Black people in particular. But he says that, I know what I'm asking you to do sounds impossible. But when you look at the history of people of color in general and Black people in particular, American history testifies nothing less than the perpetual achievement of the impossible. Mm-hmm. And so those are the cards dealt to us, right? That's what's in front of us. We can either shirk away from it or we can dive in head first and go after it. If you do those things consistently, understand who the local, activate yourself by understanding who the local players are. Mobilize by understanding the issues and being involved in the issues, and then organize to find the right people and get them elected to solve those problems. And if you can't find the right person, well, guess what? Go look in the mirror, because you just found him.
It might be you.
That's it.
Wonderful. Well, I want to ask you, as we're preparing to close, I want to ask you kind of more of a personal question. With you being a lawyer and obviously being a very engaged and very bright and very busy person, you're a family man, you have a wife, you have children. I know you have a lot going on in your life, but you are, from my perspective, you are relentless in terms of your online fight for justice and for bringing awareness to issues around race and culture and just activism and all of these things you talk about. Human rights really is what it all really falls under the umbrella of. What keeps you going? I mean, I guess partly I'm asking, what was your motivation for beginning to speak about these issues online specifically and on TikTok? And then what sort of drives you, and what keeps you going?
There's a lot of things. I think faith plays a big role in it. In Islam, Prophet Muhammad is seen as our exemplar. And I joke with my Christian friends that we don't ask, you know, what would Jesus do? Because while we love Jesus and love him more than our own parents, with Prophet Muhammad, one of the titles that God gives him is the exemplar. So we say, do what Muhammad did in every situation. You know, he was an orphan. He was unlettered. He was at some points, you know, you could argue he was powerless, right? He had no actual title or whatnot. He was single. He was married. He was a father. He was a grandfather. He lost children. His wife died of the torment that the Meccans put on him. He was a refugee. He was a general, right? He was a king. And throughout all those situations, he maintained justice above all else. There's a great quote by Sir William Muir when he talks about how after 10 years of exile, after having his family, his own children killed, his wife dying of complications from the torture that was inflicted upon the early Muslims, and they left, and then still they were pursued to be killed. And then finally, they signed a peace treaty, which was then savagely broken. And he returned to Mecca victorious with an army of 10,000. Sir William Muir writes that he had this army of 10,000, and with a single command, he could have annihilated the entire city. And no one would have blamed him for the torture that they'd inflicted upon him only because he wanted to worship in peace. But his response was to ask them, what should be your punishment this day? And they responded that our punishment should be nothing. We ask for you to forgive us for the crimes that we've committed. And the Prophet responded, as Joseph said to his erring brothers, there shall be no punishment. You are free to go. And in his lifetime, he came to an Arab society that was steeped in misogyny, in slavery, in every vice imaginable. And within a generation, he elevated women to a status of equality. He ended slavery and the slave trade. One of his closest companions was a formerly enslaved person named Bilal, who he elevated to the status of a general. I even get emotional thinking about it, but the day of the victory of Mecca, he gave the flag of amnesty to Bilal. And he said to the Meccan chiefs that if you want refuge and safety, you will find it under the flag of Bilal. So the same slave enslavers now had to go to Bilal, the person that they beat and ridiculed, and seek his safety. Like, what a powerful way to elevate someone who was despised to a leader, and then break down the racial supremacy in these Arab idol worshippers at the time, and show by example that equality of humanity is sacred and sacrosanct. In his farewell sermon, he talked about the equality of humanity. Is the two phrases of that I always cherish are, he says to men, women are your committed partners. He doesn't call them servants. He doesn't say helpers. He says they are your partners, establishing gender equality. And he said that a Black person is no better than a white, nor is a white better than a Black person. An Arab is no better than a non-Arab, nor is a non-Arab better than an Arab. And so, you know, these were literally his dying words. And so for me, that's my call to action. How do I establish justice to ensure that we have racial equality, gender equality, economic justice, in a world where all those things are fundamentally denied? And then finally, you know, I'm an immigrant to this country. And my birth country, I don't have the kind of rights that I have here. And so for me, I consider it a cherished blessing that despite America's flaws, it has some really beautiful qualities. And for me, above all of them, is this fight to become a more perfect union. And so for me, if I'm not capitalizing on that to the best of my ability, then the sacrifices of my parents and grandparents that got me here are going to waste. And so I want to do everything I possibly can to create that sense of justice with a sense of urgency. And, you know, Muhammad Ali has a great quote that I love, where he says, service to others is the rent you pay for your time here on earth. Hmm. And so my thing is, sooner or later, my time is going to come, as it comes for all of us. And I just hope that when my time comes, I've paid my rent.
Hmm. Well, I hope you have time for one more question. And this is kind of an oddball question, I guess. But I guess we've talked about what those of us who believe in sensible gun laws, what we can do and what your message would be to us and how we can mobilize. But I guess I want us to leave with you giving a message to those who maybe feel differently than we do, you know. And I grew up in the so-called heartland in Oklahoma, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and around a lot of really conservative, evangelical, very, very religious people, people of faith. And these are the folks who have been quite resistant to a lot of these conversations. And it's just, it's a non-starter. There is no conversation.
Yeah.
With a lot of these folks. So I remember when Barack Obama was running for office, he got in a lot of trouble for a line, something about people in the heartland clinging to their guns and clinging to their religion.
Yeah.
And that's an insecurity that he's describing. And so, you know, what would be your word? What words would you have to offer to someone who is perceived as clinging to guns in that way that for me comes across as insecurity?
No, that's a really, really thoughtful question. You know, when Mike Pence was governor of Indiana, he passed a red flag law that would allow someone to petition the court to say, you know, this person is going through a mental health crisis, this person is threatening suicide, this person is threatening me. And then the judge would review the evidence and then give the order for law enforcement to temporarily take away that person's guns and then until they could be certified as being safe and responsible to manage that firearm. Mike Pence passed that law. Mm-hmm. After being elected vice president, he was asked, do you regret passing that law? And he said, no, that is the standard for the entire nation. The entire nation should adopt that.
Mm-hmm.
Because Mike Pence, for all his flaws, you know, I give credit where due, he knows the FBI data that especially when it comes to women and firearms, when a firearm is present, a woman is 100 times more likely to be killed by that firearm than to protect herself with that firearm. 100 times more likely. And so that's why these red flag laws are so important. In Virginia, when Democrats got control of the House and the Senate and the governor's mansion, they took a carbon copy of Mike Pence's bill. Complete carbon copy, and said to the Republicans, hey, you guys want a bipartisan bill that we can agree upon? We agree upon this. Your vice president passed it. We're going to pass the exact same thing in Virginia. And you know what the Republicans did? They called it a gun grab. They called it tyranny.
Mm.
And so my message to those in the heartland who love their guns is to say, we actually don't disagree on the principle of gun safety. But we have become so polarized into thinking if Republicans offer a solution, it's definitely acceptable if you're a Republican, but not if you're a Democrat and vice versa. And I give this example of Mike Pence because there's not too many Democrats who like Mike Pence. Also, there's probably not too many Republicans that like Mike Pence right now anyway, but still, he was the vice president. And so here's a bill that he said worked. It actually does work, that just because Democrats propose the exact same thing, it will shut down. And so it really comes down to understanding that we all want safety.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, if somebody says, we need to ban drunk driving, I'm not going to get offended because I don't drive drunk.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason I would get offended is if I'm a drunk driver and I feel like you're personally attacking me.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I say to somebody who loves their guns, we need to ban irresponsible gun ownership, by passing these proven pieces of legislation that allows responsible gun owners to have access without issue, but it better weeds out people who are planning on doing harm. The only reason you would object to that is if you're planning on doing harm. But if you recognize that gun safety comes from responsibility, from responsible gun ownership, you should have no problem whatsoever. It is by no means an infringement of your rights if you have to wait 24 hours to get a firearm instead of immediately. It's not an infringement of rights. It's just doing due diligence. It applies to every other thing we do in life, even to voting, which is also a right. Why wouldn't it apply here as well? That's the way I would approach that conversation, to say that this is simply about making sure that the people who are responsible gun owners have access, and those who may be considering harm to themselves or others, we make it more difficult for them. There's no magical law that's going to prevent all gun violence, but if we can reduce it by a factor of 10, we absolutely should.
Well, I've appreciated this conversation, Kasim, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk about these very, very important issues. And it's good to hear your point of view, particularly from a Muslim American. And we don't get to hear that point of view enough. I particularly appreciate the story that you told about Muhammad, and just helping us to understand more of the complexities around your faith, because I think we tend to have a certain perception of Islam in this country that needs so much more nuance and so much more education and so much more understanding. So thank you for just bringing us into your world just a little bit, and helping us to think about these issues more deeply. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dara. And I should add, your commentary on Christian theology is one that I've deeply cherished as well. So it's great to jam about faith, and maybe we'll have a future conversation in more detail about that.
Yeah. I'm not as nice to my folks as you are, but I think they maybe deserve a little more criticism in this context.
You haven't seen me take out the teeth, so we'll exchange war stories at some point, I promise.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Kasim. I've enjoyed having you. Thank you.
Thank you, Dara.